now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades. This is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
We're hoping to hear from Lindsay Menz.
She said 5 minutes.
Okay, great. She's going to join our conversation. Yes. Lindsay Menz, of course, we have not spoken to on the air before. She accused Senator Al Franken of grabbing her butt while posing for a photo at the Minnesota State Fair.
In 2010.
Yeah, while he was a United States Senator. And on the phone with us as well is Stephanie Kemplin, who we did speak to previously. She was serving in the United States Army as a military police officer in Iraq when Al Franken was a private citizen on a USO tour. And she posed for a photo with Al Franken, and he grabbed her. Lindsay and Stephanie, of course, and Leanne all came forward publicly. Yesterday, the senator announced his resignation, but while announcing his resignation, he also said the following.
Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them. I was shocked. I was upset. But in responding to their claims, I also wanted to be respectful of that broader conversation, because all women deserve to be heard and their experiences taken seriously. I think that was the right thing to do. I also think it gave some people the false impression that I was admitting to doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently.
So that was a very different approach for Al Franken from what we had seen previously, which was to talk about being embarrassed and humbled and apologetic.
And how the women, I'm sorry the women feel this way. We got to understand their feelings. And
he had always left the door open, certainly with Leanne, in terms of the kiss. The photograph he couldn't deny, obviously. But the kiss, he's always talked about how he remembered it differently, but
never answered that question.
And never would define how differently he remembered it or in what way. But now when the Politico accuser, who again is unnamed, that came out yesterday.
Well, they did that to protect her identity.
Right. When she made her allegation that Senator or Al Franken, when he was hosting Air America, forcibly tried to kiss her, the senator categorically denied it. And that was the first time he just flat out said it's not true. Now he has extended that to others, presumably Lindsay Menz being one of them, because he said, I've done nothing while I'm in the Senate. Let's bring Stephanie Kemplin on board as well. Stephanie, good morning. Thanks for coming back on with us.
Morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Stephanie, first of all, what was your reaction to the senator's announcement of an impending resignation and the way in which he made his announcement?
You know, for me, it was just really disappointing. You know, it's one thing to resign your position when, you know, with the Senate, but it's another thing not to take responsibility for what you've done and deflect what you've done onto other individuals.
I felt from the beginning that Senator Franken, I mean, it's, forgive me for babbling here, but it's hard to analyze this logically, mm-hmm. because he was speaking earlier with such humility and such contrition, and then yesterday
trying to keep his job,
and then yesterday having made the decision that he was going to leave office, he basically retracted the contrition and the humility, because again, if he didn't do anything wrong, then first of all, why are you resigning? Why not go to the ethics panel and defend your reputation and you use the process that you claim you would win at the ethics committee? So why not go forward with it?
Right, and I agree, and I had been asked that numerous times. You know, if I would be willing to speak with the ethics committee. And I didn't even know that was an option. I knew that when I spoke up about him, that I would eventually have to go before them and testify under oath to what he did. And I just can't, and I feel like I'm babbling the last 2 days because I don't understand how you can make a statement like he did yesterday and feel that you can say, well, I'm just going to be great and I didn't do these things, but look at these other two men that are in, you know, political positions. And I almost felt like he was saying, well, in comparison to what they did, you know, what I did wasn't so bad. And, you know, us women who have spoken out, they misconstrued, you know, my intent behind what I did. I didn't know you could take groping any other way than just that groping, by essentially a total stranger. I mean, I know he's a celebrity, but
oh, that doesn't matter.
He's a total stranger, and I don't let men or women come up to me and grope me and fluff it off like it's nothing. Oh, it's just a misinterpretation. I mean, it's ludicrous to me. And then for him to go on and say, but look at all the wonderful things I've done as a senator. I just felt like it was a slap in the face. And it's just been so emotionally exhausting these last 24 hours to even just try to wrap my mind.
We're talking around Stephanie Kemplin, from Ohio. And, you know, your experience was back prior to Al Franken's entry into politics. Yesterday, he said something that was very nuanced, but he said that he feels strongly that he has done nothing. He said nothing twice while a member of the Senate to bring disrepute to that body. But of course, that certainly would be challenged by Ms. Mentz when she joins us, by Lindsay Mentz. But it certainly opened up the possibility of having done things prior to his being in the Senate. And that was your experience.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And the way I look at it is, what kind of individual comes over into a war zone and gropes the person who has essentially defending you and defending your freedom and your right to vote and your right to run for Senate and to hold that seat? What kind of person does it take to go in there and do that to a soldier who's going to walk out of that tent and put the uniform back on and go right back to fighting for you? I don't understand that.
Did he know you were a soldier, by the way?
I was in civilian clothes at the time. I was off duty.
That's why I'm curious if he knew whether or not. Did you have an opportunity to tell him that you were serving?
You know, I have no memory of the greetings exchanged between he and I.
We're talking with Stephanie Kemplin and, of course, Leanne Tweeden as well. The reaction, of course, has been really mostly supportive. The Washington Post this morning, by the way, has a very powerful op-ed piece written by Avi Selk. Al Franken's political career began with an apology to women. It ended without one. And it's true because, again, the senator had been apologetic for the last 2.5 weeks, but yesterday he was not apologetic. By the way, I don't have a problem with him pointing a spotlight on Roy Moore and even President Trump. That this is the conversation. It's just that what appeared to happen yesterday was a retraction of contrition that he had been expressing repeatedly, three times to Leanne Tweeden and then once publicly outside his office in that press conference, that very brief press conference. All of that was missing yesterday. And I don't know if that was just out of anger that this had resulted.
That he got caught and that he had to leave his job.
That so many of his colleagues had pulled the plug on him, but which was certainly a remarkable turn of events, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just feel like unless we had photographic evidence like Leanne did, he wants to dismiss the rest of us and call us liars. So it's, I really appreciated the dynamics between Leanne and Al Franken in the beginning. And then when the rest of us got the nerve to air our dirty laundry and come out and say, hey, this isn't a one-time thing that happened with Leanne. You know, now it's, oh, well, you're a liar. You're a liar. So I'll apologize if you have the photographic proof that shows what I've done and that I've touched you inappropriately, groped you, forcibly kissed you, whatever it is. But if you don't have that, then it didn't happen. Or I remember, you know, the situation differently.
Now, this is, of course, the problem, because photographic evidence is rare, and settlement or non-disclosure agreement agreements after settlements would certainly be evidence in most people's minds of something that had untoward had happened. But the vast preponderance of this kind of harassment happens behind closed doors in private. It's very rare that you see a situation where it happens publicly. For whatever reason, mm-hmm. there is a consistent pattern with the allegations against Mr. Franken, where he would, whether he thought it was playful or not, it was certainly intrusive, to say the least, where he would just grab people. We've seen the pictures, for instance, of him with Joy Behar and with Arianna Huffington, who are both friends of Al Franken's. One photo with Joy Behar, he has his hands on her breast, and with Arianna Huffington, he's touching her butt when they're back to back, and neither woman.
Oh, and grabbing her breast in another shot.
Right, I mean, that's right.
Both of them, he's over the top of her grabbing everything.
And they apparently didn't have any objection to it because they're friends with him, and I guess they played along with him. But the difference is, if you do that to somebody you've never met and you haven't mm-hmm. spoken to.
Well, you know what I didn't like, though, is when he first came out with this, like, oh, I hug people. I'm a warm guy. And then more and more people came out with the touching and the hugging accusations. And he's like, well, you know, when you're in a room with a lot of people and there's people bumping up against you and stuff. And it's like, okay, now you're starting to change your story. And I think that's when people started going, okay, all these women are telling the same story. And he's starting to try to, like, make little nuanced differences. And it's like, you seem like the one that's trying to change your story.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right. And I think, at least for me, I know what it sounds like. I know what it looks like. Nobody, and I've heard, you know, the negative comments. I've gotten the hate mail. I've gotten so many messages that you just have to delete.
Yeah.
You know, I'm one
don't
of those
read
people
them.
Too. Right. Just, I just don't. I honestly just don't let it get to me. It's because I know the truth. And I do have a lot of guilt that I am one of those people that sits on the other side of the TV or on the radio and I say, yeah, right. Like, you know, after 20 years, you want to come forward? And, okay, so when's the next $1 million lawsuit? I get it. I know what it looks like. And especially with him doing this in public, there were so many people around. Nobody saw anything. Or did they just brush it off because he's a comedian and that's what we do, right? Oh, you just laugh it off.
We're talking with Stephanie Kemplin. Stephanie, but we're joined by Lindsay Menz, who we have not spoken to publicly before. I've had no communication with Lindsay, and we welcome her aboard. Lindsay, good morning. Welcome to Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me.
Leanne is obviously here with us, and on the phone also is Stephanie Kemplin. Lindsay, your story, Senator Franken came up to a booth at the Minneapolis State Fair. You recognized him. He asked him for a photo, and while your husband was taking the picture with your cell phone camera, he reached behind you and grabbed your butt. Yesterday, he said that he had done nothing as a member of the United States Senate that would bring disrepute to the Senate. That seemed to be calling you out specifically, since he was a senator when that happened.
Yeah, exactly. I believe one of only two people maybe who've come forward and shared something while he was actually a senator. So him saying that nothing happened while he was a senator yesterday definitely felt directed at me, given I met him at the state fair as he was walking around doing radio interviews, you know, sharing being a senator and trying to rally support behind him.
When you heard the senator's announcement yesterday, he was stepping down. What was your reaction?
My reaction was sad. I felt sad that it got to the point where he felt like he had to step down instead of maybe owning his actions and choosing a different path forward or allowing the Senate Ethics Committee to actually do their due diligence and look mm-hmm. into the allegations against him. It kind of felt like he was just folding, if you will, in, you know, a game of cards, you fold your cards instead of following through with the game. And I felt like he was folding and not allowing the Senate Ethics Committee to complete their investigation, which kind of felt as a victim who came forward, somebody sharing my story, that he was just saying, well, you're wrong. I'm just going to walk away from this instead of allowing the truth to be revealed.
We're talking with Lindsay Mentz and Stephanie Kemplin. And of course, Leanne Tweeden. Lindsay, because you're a resident of Minnesota, you certainly were at the time. Do you have a sense of how this is being perceived in Minnesota?
So I actually don't live in Minnesota currently,
right.
But I've gotten a lot of messages from people. A lot of family and friends have reached out, and I think people are embarrassed that a state mm-hmm. representative would handle themselves in this manner. I know he has a lot of support. He does have a lot of people who have backed him, so I've heard some of those comments as well. But I have had a lot of people saying, wow, this is really embarrassing for our state. It's embarrassing that we would allow him to continue to behave this way. And just, I think, the face that this isn't the face of Minnesota that we want to show. This isn't how we want to be represented to the rest of the United States.
If the senator had stayed for the ethics inquiry, it's likely that all three of you, Leanne, Stephanie, and mm-hmm. Lindsay, would have been subpoenaed by the Ethics Committee to tell your stories. I don't know about the women who haven't come publicly forward, but since the three of you were brave enough to do so, and there, of course, there is a fourth, the woman who wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, her piece. Would you have been willing to go to Washington and tell this story, Lindsay?
Absolutely. I would have welcomed it. I would have been happy to share my story. I think that it should be something that could potentially still happen, and I would love to go before the Ethics Committee and share my story. You know, a lot of people have sent me some ugly messages saying, wait till you have to, you know, come forward and swear on a Bible and actually tell the truth. And unfortunately yeah. for them, my story won't change because it is the truth. Exactly. I'm happy mm-hmm. to do that. I'm happy to come forward. So like I said, I would welcome them still coming to ask me, go ahead and subpoena me. I'm happy to go to Washington and share my story again.
And of course, Stephanie, mm-hmm. I know you've publicly said that you would have welcomed the opportunity to testify under oath as well.
Yeah, I agree. I feel the same as Lindsay, and that I'm still very hopeful that this isn't the end, that this isn't just him walking away and saying, oh, well, I'm going to put this behind me. You know, I do welcome the opportunity to go out to Washington and tell my story. And the same as Lindsay, my story will never change. It'll never change because it's the truth. And I have no problem placing my hand on that Bible because God and I know what happened back in 2003.
And I know, Leanne, we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. You know, when this story first broke here and then it went so huge so quickly, we ended up with an impromptu press conference across the street from the radio station in right. one of our other buildings because there was such a mob of camera crews out there, and there was such interest, we literally couldn't, you know, move in the hallways.
Right.
And Leanne said at the time, we all make mistakes, and if I'm the only person, and this is a one-off, then, there she didn't call for a resignation and actually never called for Senator Franken's resignation mm-hmm. and accepted his apology. But the number got up to 8 accusers, and obviously the fellow members of the United States Senate, mostly the women, had some kind of magic number in their head when one would be too many, and apparently it was number seven when they pulled the plug on this. But when Leanne came forward, she was the only person, and the blowback and the attacks that have followed in the wake are sadly predictable. And this is happening to the women who have spoken up about Roy Moore. It's true of the women who have spoken up by name, by the way, 13, about President Trump. It's true of the women who came forward and spoke about Bill Clinton. And we can keep going back in time, including, of course, the Hill-Thomas hearings back in the early 90s when it was you're either Team Clarence or Team Anita. And there was no gray area in between. But the bullying is how all of this happened to begin with. The fear of repercussions and retribution is what silenced women to begin with. And we see it continuing to this very day.
I agree. Nothing's changed. Nothing. And I don't know when that will ever change. There will always be a stigma and there will always be a fear. And, you know, I'm sure I speak for the three of us, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we didn't come out to gain the public's approval. You know, we know our stories to be true, and we knew that there would be backlash on our families, possibly on our careers. And that's what's so shameful about all of this. Is that we continue to treat each other this way and essentially bully people and shame them into silence for fear of rocking the boat and the norm is what we have accepted as a society.
I got a feeling that it may not be perfect. It won't be perfect going forward, but it's going to be different, largely thanks to the courage of Lindsay Mentz, Stephanie Kemplin, Leanne Tweeden, and the other women who have spoken out, whether it's Harvey Weinstein or Louis C.K. or the
Matt
men
Lauer.
Who have talked about Kevin Spacey, et cetera. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank
we appreciate
you,
it. Lindsay Mentz, Stephanie Kemplin. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
We start with the passage of the tax bill in the United States Senate. This has to go, obviously, to a joint committee for reconciliation because the two bills from the House and the Senate are different, so they have to be unified before they go to the president's desk for signature. One California Republican is very much opposed to it. He's on the record as having opposed this plan. It's a pleasure to welcome back to talk about that, Congressman Daryl Issa. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine, Doug, and as of last night, there's a small glimmer of hope that the House and Senate might come up with a better bill than either one of them came up with working separately.
Congressman, I am not allowed to take the checkbook out of the House. So I'm, you know, this kind of stuff is above my pay grade. But you entered Congress after having had a very, very successful career in the private sector. So you understand the thinking in the boardrooms and how companies operate. It seems to me that the 20% cutting the corporate tax rate to 20%, if we settled on, let's say, 22%, we would be able to restore some of the popular tax cuts that have been eliminated, things like deducting college tuition loans and stuff like that. And wouldn't that be a reasonable accommodation, given the consequences of some of these losses?
Well, Doug, everyone has their favorites, but let me tell you how I'm looking at it. This is two bills combined into one. One bill, which intends to stimulate the economy, are these tax cuts for both pass-through corporations and what they call C corporations, the big ones you're familiar with. The offsetting that is $1.4 trillion, about the same cost, worth of what they call stimulus, meaning they believe the economy will grow by at least $1.4 trillion more. set that over in one side. Tax bills for reduced for corporations, greater investment, higher growth. That's the concept. Nobody that's voted for it would disagree. The other side of this is tax increases on Californians, tax increases by doing away particularly with the so-called SALT, the state and local taxes. That's almost all of the money that they're actually doing in tax increases. And then offset, they're doubling the standard deduction, doubling the child tax care, and a few other things, the estate tax. The problem is one tax cut is to stimulate the economy. The other one is picking winners and losers. And we as Californians, even without a college question, we're losers simply because eliminating the deduction for state and local taxes for people who itemize is going to be very expensive, very costly in tax increases to Californians.
I totally agree. And I just think it's a form of double taxation. But it seems to have, even though the administration has denied this, it seems to have been constructed to pay for the tax cuts on the backs of states that won't vote for President Trump anyway. I mean, by hitting New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, Illinois, California, there's not a lot of real risk that there's going to be a lot of electoral votes lost there.
Well, the interesting thing is Wisconsin and a number of other states will be affected less, but still affected, and they're voting for it. The problem is this is really, in my opinion, a Democrat tax proposal being sponsored by Republicans. What I mean by that, this makes the tax structure more progressive. It definitely picks winners and losers with significant increases in deduction or tax credits for some at the expense of others. And I don't really understand it simply because, I'd be the first to say that if you tax corporations less than the rest of the world, at or below, then we're competing not based on driving people, companies to recognize their tax, their revenues overseas. But that was what they said they wanted to fix, and it's less than half of the cost of the bill. And when they came up with this idea of eliminating the so-called SALT tax, which goes back as far back as income taxes, it's been assumed that because we are the United States of America, that states get first whack at your income, and what's left is deductible. And let me just give you an example of something that, if this is not sacred, what is? I'm sorry, I'm in Washington traffic, and
yeah,
there's always
a siren.
There's always one of those. Yes, but give you an example. California, and it could be much worse on California and Illinois, but we have countless billions of dollars of bonds out there for everything we've built and so on, schools and the like. Those, the people who buy those bonds get them tax-free, meaning that no federal taxes are paid on that. That's debt, and you and I can buy those things as tax-free bonds. Well, guess what? They didn't touch that because, quite frankly, that affects every state. And yet that would be one that would be constitutional, it'd be reasonable, because you're taxing the individual. In this case, you cannot have income in California without paying California tax. So it's not a discretion. It's not something you can change your behavior on. And certainly we're not going to change Sacramento. They're not going to lower our 13.3% tax rate. So yes, it might be very popular in Texas to laugh at California. But I'll tell you, this is a bad tax policy, because once you start down this road of not respecting the state's ability to deduct from your income and before the federal government gets to it, I think the next time it could be Democrats picking on Republicans with a similar approach. So I don't want to see it on a partisan basis. I don't want to see California picked as a loser. And it's why I said I wouldn't vote for it. I haven't voted for it. I voted to go to conference because that is a vote of disapproval of the Senate bill. But I expect if it comes out looking anything like the House or Senate bills do now, I will be voting no again.
We're talking with Congressman Daryl Issa, who you can follow on Twitter at Daryl Issa. Can I ask you a process question that those of us who are obviously not in the halls of Congress and we're far away from Washington scratch our heads at? with all, you know, reducing the corporate tax rate and tax reform is something that Republicans have campaigned on and dreamed of for many, many years. And yet it seems like the health care repeal of Obamacare, with all the years of rhetoric about that, that when it comes time to actually do it, these things are being written at the last second in the dark of night, the way I used to write my reports for school, you know, the night before. Why is it that these kinds of long-standing wish list things don't exist in some kind of a comprehensive form so that they don't appear to be done slapdash?
Well, certainly, if you're talking about the Senate repealing the personal mandate, I think that's a simple matter of what we call whip count. They go around and they say to 52 senators, will at least 50 of you vote to do this repeal? And the reason I say it that way is, if you remember, just a matter of weeks ago, famously, they couldn't get 50 senators to vote for rolling back the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And so I suspect that they weren't sure they could do it. And it wasn't until they asked specifically in light of what that cut would pay for, they came up with it. Now, I've got to tell you, I don't actually believe in that cut working out, because for your listeners, getting rid of the personal mandate, which I personally support, but when you get rid of it, saying that thus the government saves money, is to say that people who are going to get a subsidy are going to, in very large numbers, $300 billion over 10 years, not take that subsidy. Now, I know they got a score on it, but common sense says that you'll avoid the mandate if it's going to cost you money, and you're going to take the mandate if it saves you money. So I have my doubts about whether that is going to actually end up giving them the revenue that they're already spending in other parts of the bill.
Congressman, last question on a different topic. It was announced just a little while ago that Congressman John Conyers is resigning his seat in Congress. Is that the right thing for him to do?
You know, John is quite elderly. He's been struggling for quite a while. And I think in light of these revelations, going through more of it at his age is probably a combination of, yes, he doesn't want to stay around after half a century of being here with this kind of a challenge, continued investigation. I hope you also noted that he's recommending and endorsing his son [S2]
Yes. [S1]
For his seat. So there may be, quite frankly, something where that's as much of an incentive as anything else in a special election, or even as at the end of a term. With his recommendation in Detroit, he may very well be simply passing it on to his son, which I know he's wanted to do for a long time. He's considered it. I've met his son. John made some mistakes, there's no question at all, but I've served with him for a very long time, found issues we could work on, and I feel bad that he's leaving under this cloud, because in many ways he's been a solid believer in the system and a good, what they call, man of the house. So I'm not rejoicing over any of the downfalls of some of these members, maybe self-inflicted, but John Conyers deserves to be remembered for a lot of good things he did on civil rights and a host of other pieces of legislation.
All right, Congressman Issa, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
Okay, Congressman Daryl Issa. We also continue the coverage of the sexual harassment and abuse scandals, which have moved into the political arena. And we know that up in Sacramento, 140 the current or former members of the legislature and Senate and staffers and lobbyists and others who worked in Sacramento signed a letter talking about the culture of harassment in Sacramento. And now we have a named assemblyman, Matt Dabena, was accused by two women of sexual misconduct. One of them is Pamela Lopez, and this is what Ms. Lopez had to say.
Heard the door slam behind us. I spun around and realized that I was face-to-face with Matt Dabena, and that he had very quickly exposed himself.
And the door, of course, was a restroom at a Las Vegas party. To talk to us about where we go from here, it's a pleasure to welcome back to show the woman tasked with the investigation in Sacramento and that subcommittee. We've spoken to her before. We welcome back a California Assemblywoman, Laura Friedman. Good morning, Ms. Friedman. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thanks.
So this is a very specific allegation against Matt DeBobne, and he denies it. He says, quote, "I affirmatively deny that this event ever happened at any time." And that's a pretty – I'm not really sure what affirmatively deny. That's a unique sort of phrase. But it's a very emphatic denial. And now we've got a he said, she said with two accusers.
That's right. It's a very unpleasant situation for all of us who work with Mr. DeBobne. It's certainly been unpleasant for the women that have had to work with him for many years who are bringing his accusation forward. And I think the good news is that anybody in the Capitol who's been committing offenses must be shaking in their boots right now, knowing that women aren't going to be silent any longer. There's strength in numbers, and people are taking this moment and really making their voices heard.
Assemblywoman, when we get into a situation like this one where it's a he said, she said, and it's behind closed doors, we don't have, for instance, you know, Arlene Tweeden had a photograph and contemporaneous postings and stuff like that. But most of the time, these kinds of incidents take place privately. And from your position, how do you adjudicate? You've got to have hearings into this and do an investigation into this. Does it ultimately come down to just a gut feeling of who do you believe?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a prosecutor. I'm just an ordinary person who got elected less than a year ago to the state assembly. But it seems to me that if you've got a lot of people coming forward that have similar experiences and the people are credible, and these are women who work in the Capitol, they're not women that have just popped up that nobody knows. I heard the testimony. I've been able to look into their eyes, and it's very hard to understand why somebody who's working in the Capitol would bring a complaint forward that has the potential of hurting their career. You know, you have to look at patterns of behavior. You have to look at the witnesses. You're never going to get the kind of evidence that would be admitted in a court of law in a criminal offense, you know, or very rarely are you going to get those in these kinds of cases. So you have to dig deep and you know, think about the evidence that's in front of you. I can tell you that this is not easy for a lot of us in the Capitol. The Women's Caucus has really struggled with what they were going to say and what their release was going to be. But I do think it's a test of the Assembly's procedures and our willingness to look into bad doing by one of our own. You know, a lot of people are going to be watching the response of the Assembly, and we've got to get this right.
We're talking with California Assemblywoman Laura Friedman. You can follow on Twitter at LauraFriedman43. The proceedings, whatever, I mean, you mentioned that you're not an attorney, you're not a judge, you're not a jurist. But similarly, whatever findings your committee comes up with is not a court of law either. It is simply a committee that has been empaneled to deal with an internal matter affecting the working conditions in Sacramento. If it should go forward past that to removal, then obviously that's a different process.
Well, let me be clear. My committee is looking at the Assembly's rules and procedures with regards to sexual harassment and training. We are not looking into any particular cases. So what will happen with Matt DeBobne accusation is that they will be an outside investigator hired. And those results could go back to the speaker. They will go back to the speaker, who could move for immediate expulsion without the case coming in front of the ethics committee. That's my understanding. Or it could go in front of the ethics committee, which I don't head. That's Eloise Reyes. It could also be brought back to the rules committee, which I sit on. Ken Cooley is the chair of the rules committee. So, yes, this might end up coming in front of me from my position on the rules committee, but my subcommittee will not be hearing this case.
Can you just walk us through, because when we think about removing an elected official, we think of impeachment. How does this work in the Assembly and the Senate that they can move for immediate expulsion? How does that process work?
It's so rarely done. My understanding is that it's never been done, but you can remove someone with a two-thirds vote. And it's my understanding, and I've been looking into this, that that removal would actually remove them from office, not just expel them from the body. But it would take a two-thirds vote of the assembly to do that for an assembly member.
Now, we know with Raul Bocanegra that the threat of this essentially resulted in his resignation. He was going to hang in there until next September, which would have been September 2018, I mean, almost a year from now. And then the pressure finally mounted, and I assume some of that pressure came from Anthony Rendon, the assembly speaker, and people saying it's time to, you know, clean out your office. So we didn't really get a test of immediate removal. This might be the case if Mr. Dubovne insists on his innocence and denies all the charges and his colleagues believe the accusers, then he's going to have obviously a decision to make.
Yeah, this is going to be very rough going from here for him. He has hired a lawyer. He's denied the accusations. He is clearly thinking that staying and fighting is his best move, rather than stepping down and admitting, or as Mr. Bocanegra did, stepping down and still denying the charges. I'm not sure that this is the best move for him, but we'll see where it goes.
How often does your committee meet? When does it meet? What are the hearings like?
Well, the Rules Committee meets weekly. My committee, the subcommittee, has only met once. We were formed in June, and I activated the committee after all of this started coming out in the Capitol and after the Me Too letter, of which I was a signatory. So we had our first meeting, which was over a five-hour hearing on last Tuesday, and it was a very honest hearing. I think anybody who thought that the committee was going to be window dressing realizes now that it's a very serious attempt to, first of all, expose what's been happening in the Capitol. And we had some of these same women come and speak and tell us their experiences, and other women who came and told us their experiences. And then we also heard from experts who talked about ways that we can address these issues and make a much better system, a system that's more protective of victims, fair to people that are accused, but has real repercussions. So we'll be meeting again in January to continue going forward, hearing from more experts about different ways of having independent review and trustworthy investigations and better procedures.
Well,
we'll have either one or two more hearings before we make recommendations to the Rules Committee to adopt.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking down the road. Thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate it. You can follow Laura Friedman on Twitter at LauraFriedman43. She represents the 43rd District, by the way, California Assemblywoman Laura Friedman. We are about to talk to a woman who has had one of the most remarkable careers in publishing ever as a journalist, as a columnist, as a publisher, as an editor. She has run some of the major publications in all of the printed world, the New Yorker magazine, Vanity Fair, of course, and launched the Daily Beast, which I've had the privilege of writing for. She has a new book out called The Vanity Fair Diaries, about those amazing years in the 1980s running Vanity Fair. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Tina Brown. Good morning, Ms. Brown.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you for being with us on this very busy news day. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is you had a very significant professional partnership with Harvey Weinstein and Miramax when you launched Talk Magazine with him, and you've not been shy in calling him a monster. What was your experience?
Well, you know, he's a bombastic, profane, dishonest individual, and that I saw. Certainly didn't see this kind of marauding beast that he was sexually. I didn't see that, but I did see that he was pretty ugly in business, and frankly, therefore, his character was not as much of a surprise, perhaps, as it might have been. But what was a surprise was just how the extent of his violence against women, which I certainly didn't see.
Are you surprised, having run major companies and being a female boss of major organizations, are you surprised to see how commonplace the hashtag MeToo stories have become?
No, because honestly, women, this has been the dirty secret that women have had to live with for so long. And it's really been the water in which they swam very often. You know, it's like people just, it's so common, frankly, sexual harassment, that I think women have very often not even, like, shared this stuff except to their intimate girlfriends. So it doesn't surprise me, honestly, that women have stories to tell. What is exciting is the fact that they're finally sticking. You know, I run Women in the World now, which convenes extraordinary women to tell their stories. And last April, in our summit, we had a whole conversation about this before all these stories broke. And one of the big messages was HR is not your friend. HR is not going to be telling women how to get redress when they have sexual harassment much of the time. They're about protecting the company, which means silencing you and getting you out. So that's been one of the big issues, I think, for women.
We're talking with Tina Brown, former Vanity Fair editor. She's the author of The Vanity Fair Diaries, 1983 to 1992, which is available now wherever books are available, including e-reader versions. And you can follow her on Twitter at Tina Brown LM. Tina Brown LM.
Can I just make a comment real quick?
Yeah, I just want to introduce you. Okay. Tina, Leanne Tweeden, who is my news anchor on the show here every day, was the principal accuser of Al Franken.
I do know. Congratulations.
And one of the points I wanted to make is that it has been my observation that when you come out and you speak about a political figure, there is a level of harassment that comes towards the accusers that does not, I mean, as bad as it is for the regular sort of accusations, the political people fight back either directly like Roy Moore and President Trump or covertly through surrogates.
Well, it's ironic that actually the media have done a better job at being policing their own ranks by far than The Hill has, you know, and then Washington has. It seems like, you know, what do you have to do to get redress in Washington? It seems as if the endless attempts to protect everybody are just, you know, ongoing. And, you know, I mean, let's hand it to these big media companies. Finally, it's certainly taken them enough time, really, but they have finally sort of toppled the abusers in their midst. You know, I mean, listen, as a woman, you know, throughout my whole editing career, I've had men come on to me, obviously. You know, the difference though was for me is that I was a boss lady, and that is the whole issue. The core issue of this is, you know, I was an editor at the age of 25 and, wow, and then went on to be an editor in chief in many places. So I therefore, you know, controlled my own world. And therefore, I didn't have the experience of abuse of power. I think we have to remember that what is the worst thing about this sexual harassment is when a woman feels that there's a transaction that's required in order for her to get ahead. Mm-hmm. And that is just the most appalling abuse of power, as we've seen in all of these cases. It's women feeling, I can't speak out because my career will be hurt. I didn't actually have to deal with that. What I had to deal with when I was at Vanity Fair was an ongoing sort of belittling, in a sense, of as a woman, you know, in that kind of media marketplace, feeling all the time that you had to be gold in a silver job, that you had to always, you know, the sense of having to try harder,
right,
than
or justify any man has to why try. You were there in your position,
to justify what I'm there to justify, mm-hmm, my, you know, to own my success and be allowed to own my success, was just much more difficult. And you know, when I look at the tape of myself in that era in the 80s, it's like it stunned me when I saw the CBS show recently about my years there, was how when I was presenting the magazine to the management, it was me and 9 or 10 men around a table, all kind of male white men. You know, white men. And when I got pregnant, you know, the HR said to me, this is great news, she said, you know, we get the chance to test our maternity policy. So at that time, I was just kind of, as a young woman taking over a position of power, I was really just blazing ahead and trying to get the work done. And you really never stop to think that this was an entirely male environment that was in so much of the time with regard to the power dynamics, you know.
It's very interesting, you know, with me, just a couple points I'm going to make. With the Al Franken thing, a lot of the people that are coming at me and just, you know, sort of maligning my character and things like that have been women, which has surprised me.
Very depressing. I mean, that's
is.
The third rail nobody wants to really talk about is when women become so sewn into the cultural,
yes,
mode, as it were, that they end up being the protectors and sort of protectors of the status quo, because a lot of the time they've made those compromises themselves, you know, so they've had to kind of you know, they then feel, well, this is the way it works, and they sometimes resent those who want to upset the apple cart.
Exactly. And then the other thing that you were talking about earlier about women just, you know, swimming through the waters our whole career, it's funny, I was talking the other day, my makeup artist best friend, I was just doing a shoot, and she was like, you know, I was trying to think back when all this this Me Too stuff was happening. And, you know, I can't really think of a time when I don't think that's ever happened to me in my career. And then she started talking about one of our friends and she made a comment. And I said, Michelle, that is sexual harassment right there. And she didn't even realize it because it was just part of the culture. And I'm like, that, all of that has been sexual harassment. She didn't even realize it because it was just the way it was.
It's just the way it was, exactly right. So, you know, I mean, I guess one of the fun things for me to do when I was really doing this book was looking at my diaries and realizing just how hard it was, you know, how one was always battling everything all the time. And it was fun, though. I mean, you know, it also created muscle, you know, at the end of the day, turning around something that's failing and being young and having to fight that sort of male skepticism and you know, was made the muscles that kind of also helped to make that success. So, you know, and I had great male mentors, too. I mean, we don't want to always say the males are the bad guys.
Oh, that's what I say. There's a lot of great men out there.
A lot of great guys.
Absolutely.
I mean, Simon Newhouse, who was the chairman of Condé Nast and who I worked for 18 years, I mean, he was really so supportive of me, actually. I mean, he maddened me at times when he kind of, I felt, didn't quite give me the same kind of sort of seat at the table that some of the males.
Well, we wish you continued success, Tina Brown, which is undoubtedly going to come your way. The book is called The Vanity Fair Diaries, 1983 to 1992, and on Twitter at Tina Brown LM. Tina Brown, thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you
so much.
This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.